Your Honor, Matthew Nelson on behalf of the state of East Holton. In this case, the district court heard by underemphasizing the fact that McKay has already given RMH almost 100% of the value that RMH is entitled to under the party's contract, and thus overemphasized ambiguities at best, the level of indefiniteness to find that there was no contract. The party's contract here is simple. McKay would disclose this idea worth tens of millions of dollars to RMH if RMH agreed to three conditions. There is no dispute in the record that there is no dispute that there is record evidence that RMH agreed to McKay's terms, either orally or by conduct, causing McKay to give RMH the valuable idea. RMH didn't want McKay's services. Under the agreement, there was no obligation to move forward. It wanted McKay's idea, and it got the idea. McKay has almost fully performed under the contract, and under Virginia law, courts are loath to deem a contract.
So now, what were the terms of the contract?
Your Honor, the terms of the contract were that McKay, on the one side, would disclose its idea, RMH, in exchange for RMH agreeing to keep the idea confidential, and if RMH decided to go forward with the idea, RMH would use McKay to go forward, and it would pay McKay 20% of the adjustment in its federal health care reimbursements that it received as a result of the idea for up to 4 years.
And you base that latter term on what?
Excuse me?
That latter term, 20% of the adjustment for 4 years, is based on what?
The term is based on, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand what you're asking.
Parties made a contract, right, that I assume you're saying was an essential term of the contract, where do we find that?
You find it in the email that Mr. Brown sent to Ms. Holsinger on May 18th. And then you find it again repeated by McKay Consulting during the June 3, 2009 meeting.
This is where I have my first difficulty with understanding the contract in this particular case, because that term seems to be fairly ambulatory. When you look at this May 26th email, it says the fee would be 20% of the adjustment. It doesn't tell you what the adjustment is of, but it says 20% of the adjustment. Then there's a written contract that's tendered, and that written contract says 20% of the additional reimbursement for 3 years. And in addition to that, there's an email, I think, on May the 19th that says increased reimbursements. But it's even more complicated for me because when I look at both counts in the complaint, the prayer for relief asks in both counts for 20% of additional revenues, but right before that, it pleads 20% of any additional reimbursements. So my initial difficulty with your argument is there are at least four different utterances of what you say the essential term is, and even in your own complaint, you have two completely different terms in both counts. Even today, I don't know what the contract terms are.
Your Honor, I think the evidence that would be in front of the jury here where they consider what the term was the email says adjustment. adjustment that the parties understood, having had the conversation that same day, that we were talking about an issue with regard to healthcare reimbursements. That Mr. Brown and Ms. Holzinger had had a telephone conversation saying, we have an idea with regard to federal healthcare reimbursement, Medicare and the like. That evidence would be there. The evidence would also be there from what Ms. Holzinger, Ms. Reiner, Mr. Brown, and Mr. McKay testified about with regard to what was said at the June 3 meeting. And from those, a jury could infer what the term here is.
But here in this, you know, the district court made two determinations. It determined there was no meeting of the minds on compensation. And then, collaterally, I think there's an alternative holding that any term of compensation was just too vague to ever be reasonably ascertained. And here, you know, as the plaintiff, it's your burden to plead, and the plaintiff can't rise above his or her its own evidence. And here you've got, by my count, four different terms, none of which are the same. And if the issue goes to summary judgment on whether or not there's a contract, and you can't tell us what the contract is, how can you survive summary judgment?
Your Honor, I believe the complaint may not have been the most artfully fled. That obviously reimbursements and the adjustment are the same thing. The issue with regard to the contract that was tendered after the fact, there's evidence in the record that shows that the three-year term was in fact a typo, that it should have been a four-year term. And ultimately, I would submit that that would be an issue for the jury to decide whether the parties in fact on June 3 agreed to a four-year term or whether this is evidence that there should have been a three-year term.
I thought your position was the contract was already made when the written contract was submitted.
It was, Your Honor. I believe what happened afterwards, the contract was submitted for the purposes of documenting the agreement that had already been made. There was a typo there. As I said, the evidence here, obviously this is a summary judgment standard, must be construed in favor of the non-moving party.
No, but you were saying the jury would have to decide. They couldn't decide that issue.
I agree. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misspoke. Ultimately, the crux of the matter here under Virginia law, I would suggest, is that this contract was, in fact, almost fully performed by McKay. Consequently, when you look at the Virginia cases that address determining whether a contract is so indefinite as to be not a contract, where there's partial performance, the cases that you turn to are RK Chevrolet and Hynon. In both those cases, the court considered the absence of certain terms, the ambiguity of the certain terms, and said a reasonable jury, based with these facts, could come to a conclusion as to what the parties reasonable certainty had agreed to, and concluded that summary judgment was not appropriate. When you turn also to the idea disclosure cases, across the country, you find that courts and idea disclosure cases, because of the nature of the property interest in an idea and the necessity to, of course, share the idea with a person who you would hope will purchase it, at the same time not wanting to give them the idea so that they'll walk away with it, use it, and then not pay you for it, which we would submit as what has happened here. In those cases, courts are willing to imply terms even as essential as payment. And I would point the court to the Desney case and the Wrench case cited in our brief.
One of the things I don't understand about this is you've got an idea, a great idea, and it can save this bank, the hospital, millions of dollars. It would seem to me that going in to make this presentation, you would make sure every I was dotted, every T was crossed. there will be no question that the person you're dealing with has got authority to do it, and they're going to be locked in beyond any doubt once you present the idea to them and reveal the idea. And yet this seems to be almost haphazard that they're going to a lower ranking person in the hospital who may or may not have apparent authority. Now, we've got this idea, if you agree to pay us a lot of money, we'll pay you. Then they spring it on. So anyway, go ahead. I'm just curious.
Your Honor, my clients have done this across the country with numerous different clients and have had and routinely meet with people at the director level and routinely form these types of contracts. The record reflects that my client has not done this specifically with Soul Community Hospital status before. However, the underlying step of taking a hospital from urban to rural to some higher compensation, to some higher classification or some perhaps a geographic reclassification is something that the record reflects my client has done on numerous occasions, and the record reflects that on more than 20 occasions, those contracts have initially been formed with people at the director level. This is the way the industry functions.
Right. Is there a time limit on when the hospital can do these things? Is there any kind of statute of limitations? But obviously, the hospital is held off doing it. Obviously, the hospital wants to do it, or they still wouldn't be fighting these things. So is there a time limit involved in when they could make the switch if they ultimately decide to do it?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad that you brought that up because there is an issue which I believe the court can take judicial notice of. The hospital has reclassified as a rural Soul Community Hospital. So they have that.
Well, it's obvious they won't do it. They wouldn't still.
Correct. And I think that demonstrates the fact that the idea that we brought to them had value. In terms of is there a time limit under the contract for them?
Under the law.
They can do it anytime they want to, in other words. In other words, they could do it 10 years from now. Presuming there's no change in the law.
Presuming there's no change in the law, and in this area, that's always questionable. And they've mentioned, and I think this court has recognized that these particular statutes and regulations change for incredible reasons.
Let me ask you a question about the particular details of this contract. I understand your argument to be, and I don't agree with this, that so long as the parties agree on essential terms, the particulars of how the contract is going to be performed or details that don't really matter as to the sufficiency of the contract. But there was one detail in particular that I found troubling that, at least as a party, I would have liked to have known on the front end, and perhaps goes to this issue of whether or not the parties had a meeting of the mind, and that is the fact that the hospital was going to be required to incur losses on the front end in order to earn a profit if it ever did. But it seems to me that that's a pretty important point that one would want to know before entering into an agreement of this type.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the issue there is that the contract here was for the disclosure of the idea, not to go forward. The issue of the loss came if RMH decided to go forward, and only if they decided to go forward. So that this issue of incurring the upfront loss would only occur if they went forward, and in fact, to put finer points on it, would only be incurred if they in fact obtained the SVH status. So in other words, the way you go through this process is you submit your application to become rural and condition it upon meeting the requirement for SVH status. So only if we can be a Soul Community Hospital. Do we want to become rural? Once they grant the SVH status, the rural status is retroactively effective to the application date. So there's not a risk that you start this process out and then have losses out in the future if you file the paperwork properly.
Is that something that was disclosed to the hospital?
Not before the contract was formed, Your Honor. I don't know if in the discussions on June 3, that specific connection was made.
Did you say the contract was long before that?
No, Your Honor, I say that the contract was formed on June 3.
That's the initial meeting?
That's the initial meeting.
And the brochure or the notebook was given to them, that told them that they could go to rural hospital status without having and be able to renege on that if they didn't get sold into the hospital status?
I don't know. I don't believe that that detail of the process is set forth in the notebook.
Well, to follow Judge Diaz's question, that would seem to be a pretty important detail. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, you're going to make a lot of money. It's something else to say, oh, by the way, you're going to lose millions to start with. And an even more important detail to say, if you don't get this other status, sole community hospital, you could be losing millions indefinitely.
Well, Your Honor, I believe what the issue here is, they ultimately have the choice of going forward. If they were to decide to go forward, or if they were to have had the conversations further with regard to going forward, all of these details would have been resolved in terms of a discussion between my client and the hospital as consultants. I'm out of time, but I'm more than happy to continue.
What you're saying is, yes, there are these problems. We'll tell them about them. They don't want to do it. They don't want to go forward. Don't want to seek this change. They don't have to.
Correct. If they decide,
but if they do, after having been told all this, then they owe you.
Correct.
All right, let's hear from Mr. Dick.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Dan Fitch, and I represent Rockingham Memorial Hospital. The district court properly held in this case that a reasonable jury could not find that K&RMH mutually assented to essential contract terms that were both complete and certain. As a matter of law, neither the compensation term nor the agency term will ever establish a reasonable certainty at the moment that K intends the contract is formed. Now, as to that lack of mutual assent, there can be no meeting of the mind here based upon a secret purpose. And here, McKay actively concealed and intentionally omitted and intentionally, in fact, misrepresented information essential to establish compensation and agency terms of reasonable certainty. McKay's offer was legally inoperative because it did not contain all of the essential terms of the contract he made.
What did it omit?
It omitted, as one for one thing, Your Honor, the fact that there were upfront losses of up to $2 to $3 million. Everything went smooth.
And so what? But that's not. It's not requiring you to do anything. You contract, viewing the testimony like most stable then as just like that. They just said, here's the idea. You can do it. You cannot do it.
Two responses to that. Okay. First, it matters hugely as it relates to the compensation. Okay, on page 37 of its materials, asked this court to adopt three forms. The contract, it says, requires that you take 20% of the adjustment for up to 4 years adjustment after it's materialized. We then ask the court to rewrite three forms. The first one is the difference to adjust, which is payment, FCH status, plus current payment, urban hospital status, without finding. And the second formula is now in year one, which will be 20% of that difference, less the transaction cost, versus another that doesn't be 2 years long. And then in the out years, not accounting for the fact that we could be definitely stuck in rural status, sustaining losses for years, we only get to transition for 1 year.
You're changing issue on me. What you argued first was they didn't tell us they were going to be upfront losses.
That's right.
And that's what I was trying to understand, how that impacts whether or not there was a contract or not, that they give you the idea, and if you decide to use it, you owe.
Because it relates to compensation. Under their formula, compensation in year one is 20% times this difference, which is another formula, less the transaction cost. And they claim that we knew that at the time and that we assented to that compensation term, which included the netting out of these upfront losses in year one without knowing for a minute, without having the vaguest idea that there ever was an upfront loss. The hospital was told going into this, we found $500,000 or in excess of $500,000 in the cost. What happens all the time, Your Honor, cost reports like corporate taxes just tallies up with expenses and payments for a hospital. And sometimes there are errors in the cost reports, and sometimes
here, we're taking the hospital to a new classification, which is going to sustain millions of dollars in upfront loss. Anything else here? In terms of the scope of the service, I mean, agency, those are the two terms. Services, this is a fee for services contract. Services, compensation. Without knowing that we're going to be losing $2 to $3 million per year, we can't know what services are that they're going to provide. And we can't also know what the compensation is going to be that we're going to pay. There's just no way we can know that. We have to know that information. And we had no ability to send the compensation information.
Well, I guess the issue for the consulting company, though, is if you give too much information, you've essentially given away the idea without the benefit of a binding agreement. So how, I mean, aren't they entitled to some leeway with respect to that?
Great question. This is not an idea submission. This is an idea. An idea submission. Your idea submission page. Hopefully you're saying, I've got the script. Here's my sitting to you.
I think I'm going deaf. Can you move the microphone? Move it close. Once you start talking and you move away from it, I want to make sure I hear everything.
Yes, sir. So the pure idea submission contract in the entertainment industry, I've got the script for Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you and I have lunch, and I disclose it to you, and all I need is a non-disclosure. You can't use this. This is a truly novel and original idea. You're stuck. You can either use it and negotiate with me and we can come to terms on compensation or not. But that's not what McKay had. McKay had some federal changes. Congress changed the law in 2008. And it figured out a way, before the hospital did, to get to sole community hospital status. But guess who else had that idea? PricewaterhouseCoopers, Baker Healthcare, Dixon Hughes, who brought us the same proposal a couple months later. They've got competitors out there. And so what they have isn't a truly novel and original idea. What they've got is a law change. I don't have a monopoly or a claim on the law, but I do have this proposal that will get RMH.
They had an idea that the hospital didn't have it. Other people may have had it, but the hospital didn't have it.
And so what do they need, Your Honor, in order to protect that? They need two things. They need non-disclosure, and they need non-competition.
I completely agree. This could have been handled a whole lot better, and a lot of things would have been a whole lot clearer, but how we get our cases.
But they need non-disclosure, and they need non-competition, because it wasn't the idea that they were trying to protect. It was, there's going to be somebody knocking on the hospital's door in 2 months, and we've got to lock these guys down in non-competition. Or Dixon Hughes is going to be in there. And guess who came to our door a couple months later with the identical idea that gave us all of the terms, including the upfront losses, including the specific terms of compensation, and including the specific scope of services? Good old Dixon Hughes. So they needed that, but they intentionally kept the information from us because it wasn't the script from Indiana Jones. It was something that the court found, and this is unappealed, that this was an idea that was readily ascertainable. It was in the public domain. It was something that that competitors were out there, and this particular group had run into those competitors in the previous 3 months with three other hospitals.
Let me interrupt for just a sec. Could they have disclosed their idea to you? Could they have disclosed that there were going to be upfront losses initially in millions of dollars without disclosing their idea? Or as you said, they should have told us these things. Could they have told them to you without revealing what their idea was?
Possibly, Your Honor. But the easiest way to do it, and the way that is typically done, is you get non-disclosure and non-compete. And they didn't get, they got confidentiality. We told you, we'll protect our binder. We protected the binder. We protected it to this day. That was the only information that they gave us. They didn't have a monopoly on the Federal Register, on the federal regulations or congressional acts. We returned the binders to them. What they really wanted was non-compete, and that's what they're really asking this court to write today, because absent that exclusivity on agency, Dixon Hughes comes in 2 months later and gives us the exact same idea, then where's the nexus between the use of what the pay brings to us and our use of what Dixon Hughes brings to us? They're bringing us the same idea. They're not bringing us something novel and original. They're bringing us the same proposal. And therein lies the problem.
So if they had come to you and said, we have this idea, it's going to cost you several million dollars up front, but at the end of the four-year period, you will net over $500,000 a year, you would not have agreed to that.
Well, it was very interesting, and the record is that Mr. Brown stated to Ms. Holzinger, if I had told you that the magnitude of the benefit was over $2 million, you wouldn't have even met with us because that would have defined the scope of the fee. The scope of the fee was based upon a basis that was never disclosed to the hospital, and that in turn was based on losses that were never disclosed to the hospital. So the hospital had absolutely the mutual assent on the compensation term was absolutely impossible because the hospital had no idea what the magnitude of the benefit was or what the magnitude and the certainty, the absolute certainty of these upfront losses were going to be, nor any idea who was going to be responsible for that loss and for how long that loss was going to occur. Moreover, on agency, how in the world could this hospital have ever assented to a scope of services? No services were ever described, the service to be provided, the time frame within which they were to be provided. The K has expressly asked this court, I would ask the court if it has time to look at pages 1425 and 1426 of the record, because in that there are very detailed fee provisions and very detailed service provisions relating to an identical, very similar contract. And McKay, in his brief, has asked the court, as it relates to the fee agreement, how these fees are going to be calculated, how they're going to be accounted for under this very difficult Medicare reimbursement and reconciliation provision. It goes on for two pages as to how that process is going to be done and who's going to be responsible. They also asked the court that that would be a good idea also on the compensation term. And yet we had no idea of what services they were going to be providing whatsoever. They have absolutely unbridled ability to provide what services they want, when they want. They could simply leave the binder and say you're on your own, RMH, or they could do a whole lot more. There's no time of services, and there's no description of services. There's no description of what RMH is obligated to do. There's no description of who's responsible. This is an interesting concept because this is not a simple, we're just going to audit your to see if you got a concussion or a brain aneurysm and get you coded right. This is taking us from a rural urban hospital to a rural hospital and then taking us back to Seoul Community Hospital, which we knew how to do. The hospital had been that before. And there's two tests for that under the statute, 42 CFR 412.92. One is a proximity test. You have to be within 25 or 35 miles of a like-kind hospital. But the other one is really tough. It takes a lot of analysis, and that is that you have to do a market share test. And on the market share test, you have to define a geographical area, and then you have to have 75% of the Medicare inpatients within that geographical area qualify. Who's responsible for getting that right? And what if they're the ones that are filing the application, and they get it wrong? We're in urban status. We're now in rural status for 9 months. We've lost $4.5 million. And they say, sorry, we got the market share test wrong. We'll help you get back to urban hospital. And then next year, they want to do the process again, or we want to do the process again because the market share test is now satisfied. Do we have to use them again? According to what they're asking this court to write, there are exclusive forever. There are exclusive agents forever. We have to use them.
I thought it was a four-year contract.
That just speaks to the payment term, Your Honor. And we're not even sure about that because they send us a written contract the next day with a merger clause voiding all prior agreements with brand new compensation terms, as Judge Agee just pointed out, and a three-year payment term. Now, if I could take a minute on the payment term itself, because when does that start? Because that's a material, essential term to this contract. When do we have to start paying them this 20% of something that they didn't tell us it was? Well, according to them, it's when the adjustment materializes. Now, there were only two representatives of McKay at that June 3 meeting, Mike McKay, the president, and Bob Brown, the consultant. And they testified that an adjustment can be a loss. as to when the compensation, the payment term begins, Mr. Brown says, well, the payment term begins, the four-year payment term begins when the loss materializes. In other words, when you start taking rural payments as a rural hospital, you start losing $500,000 a year, that's a loss. And your four-year clock or your three-year clock, if you believe the next day's contract, starts running. Mike McKay, who testified, they couldn't get their state, can't even agree on when the commencement of the payment term starts. He says, yes, a loss is an adjustment, but the repayment obligation, the payment of the fee doesn't begin until RMH obtains sole community hospital status. And there's no requirement in the regulations as to when that happens. CMS has to act on a rural application within 60 days, and it's retroactive to the date of the application. It has no fiscal intermediary, and the Center for Medicare Services has absolutely no deadline within which to pick a rural hospital's application to become a sole community hospital. That can be wild.
Have you had experience in dealing with contracts that are initially made between CEOs, officers of a company, and then they say, our lawyers will work out the details. You know, we'll have a written contract later. Yes. And then they dispute and argue over the details. But the basic contract, are you familiar?
Absolutely. And very interesting you asked that question, because let's look at what happened here. Negotiation began almost immediately. On what? On compensation. First of all, they walk into the CFO's office, and immediately McKay offers up a 19% fee percentage. Then RMH rejects that. They walk out and they say, we don't think that there's an agreement. One of the individuals thinks that it's a lock, the other one doesn't. RMH comes back and says, we'll be willing to discuss this with you, but let's talk about this on an hourly basis, on a fixed fee basis. That's rejected. Then 2 weeks after this contract is allegedly formed, there is a writing from McKay back to RMH that says, make us an offer on the compensation plan. Make us an offer. Well, that's strong evidence that there was not only meeting of minds on the compensation term, but there was ongoing negotiation, which is powerful evidence that no contract was ever formed. To your point, Judge Traxler, so this meeting takes place, this contract that they claim is either an oral or implied in fact contract arises on June 3, and then what do we get the next day? We get the two-page written contract, and I'd ask the court to take a look at that on page. ...2431 of the record, because we get that a day later, exactly to your point, with a different compensation term, with different requirements for handling materials as trade secrets, and all sorts of new terms, and merger clause saying everything we talked about before is voided. So that's handed out in a three-year payment term, by the way, not a four-year payment term, and saying that's the starting point for this new contract. And it goes to Judge Agee's point, because there were no fewer than four compensation terms bannered around of this. They're claiming, no, those were definite, those were certain, those were fixed. But the email and what was reportedly reiterated at the June 3 meeting when the contract was reportedly formed was 20% of the adjustment for up to 4 years adjustment after it's materialized. Then on the June 4 contract that I just referred to you, the written contract proposes a price term of 20% of the additional reimbursement for the first 3 years for which the service has a positive effect. So now the adjustments and the upfront losses are sort of mushy, we're talking only positive effects for prospective benefits. Then in the complaint, they asked for 20% of any increased reimbursements for up to 4 years. And then in their prayer for relief, when they asked the court, and they're really negotiating the court on these terms, to impose a contract term of 20% of any additional revenues that RMH receives as a result of the IDEA for up to 4 years. So absolutely, that happens all the time. And when you look at what happened here, the ongoing negotiation establishes that there was not mutual assent to the compensation term. There was not a meeting of the minds. There was certainly intentional omissions. And it says nothing also of the fact that here, when you look at the magnitude of the benefit, and I think Judge Conrad was troubled by this, this in excess of $500,000 was not some plus or minus. They were off by an order of magnitude of 16, but the $8 to $9 million benefit that was in the disclosure binder was based on a formula. It was the Cook RMH's case mix. What kind of patients do you have? Do you have heart patients and brain injury patients, and the number of Medicare inpatients, and then it multiplied that times the new hospital specific rate that Congress authorized in late 2008.
Yeah, this is the first case I've ever had where somebody complained about the fact they were going to make way more money than they ever thought they were going to make. That it was their fault to say you're only going to make $500,000, but really it's going to be $8 million.
But it goes
I've never had that case, situation.
But it goes to the ascent. It goes to ascent in terms of services, John. What were they going to do for us? What were they going to do? It was going to, they held it out as they concealed it as a retrospective analysis. We found $500,000 in the cost.
They were going to make, the hospitals were going to make way more money than they were originally.
And they concealed the magnitude of the benefit. They concealed, in fact, omitted the fact that we were going to have $2 to $3 million in upfront losses if all went well. And they concealed the fact that there was a high probability that, or some probability that it could fail. And who was going to be responsible for that? There was no meeting of the minds on that. There was no mutual assent. They gave us a 35-page legal opinion from a Medicare lawyer in Washington, D.C., the upshot of which is that the CMS might turn this down, you might have to appeal it, and you might have to take it to federal court, the Painesville Community Hospital says. Who was going to do that in terms of scope of services? I mean,
which is a business judgment for the hospital to make. Do we want to take this chance? Do we want to run this risk? Don't want to run it? Fine.
Your Honor, but we're talking here about a contract, and the contract requires definite terms to which the parties mutually assented, and that's impossible here. That's the problem. It's not that the proposal wasn't a good one. It wasn't that the calculations could have been fine-tuned and that there could have been some business judgment applied. The problem was that McKay tried to come in and lock down a non-compete and lock out the competition without disclosing what it was going to do, what it was going to cost to the hospital, what the risks were, and more importantly, what the services were. There's no services defined here. There's none. And this is not a pure idea submission case where they say reasonable compensation will do. They have a defined compensation term that is so indefinite and so susceptible of meaning as to be unenforced. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Nelson, you have some time reserved for reply.
Your Honor, I would first like to point out that the services, as RMH has pointed to, that were to be provided under the contract was the idea. McKay came to RMH and said, we believe we have a reimbursement issue for you that would give you additional federal health care reimbursements in excess of, and then later, much more than $500,000 per year. And we'll tell you what the issue is if you agree to these terms.
Are you selling more than the idea? Are you selling services?
We're selling, yes, but only as incidental to the idea.
Yes, you're selling just the idea, or yes, you're selling services too.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we are selling services too, but only as incidental to the idea, as the terms show.
Where do we find?
We find this when we say that you agree to use McKay going forward, that essentially McKay will be your agent going forward. You find that in the Bob Brown email. You also find it reiterated at the beginning of the June 3 meeting. And you have Ms. Reiner, who is there for RMH, saying she understood that even before the issue was disclosed, the condition was that that RMH would go forward with McKay if they decided that they wanted to.
So it's not just an idea. definitely set an agency relationship. And that's what it says in the email. 20%. Well, we'll ask that you keep it confidential and if you choose to address it, you'll use McKay Consulting as your agent.
Only if you choose to address it.
But I think I understood the point of construction question. It's not just an idea. We're also selling a service, agency relationship. I think that was Mr. Fitch's point. Nobody knows what that agency relationship entails.
Well, in fact, I think Ms. Reiner's testimony demonstrates that a jury could conclude that it was apparent to the hospital what it was that the agency relationship was. In fact, what you had here was two sets.
What would that be? What would that agency relationship be? What did the hospital know or should have known it was going to do?
That McKay would provide the consulting services, just like the other consultants that they had hired, to fill out the appropriate paperwork in conjunction with the hospital to go forward with the idea. I'd like to also
rephrase this question for my point. How would the hospital know what its responsibilities were and McKay's responsibilities were with regard to getting this? How would they know who was supposed to do what?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that it would be just like any other healthcare reimbursement contract that with a consultant that they've ever entered into, that there is a collaborative process whereby the consultant provides the paper, files the paperwork, provides the analysis, and the hospital provides the data. Ms. Holsinger had done numerous of these contracts before, understood how this works. This is, again, I believe, from a reasonable juror who concludes from the context that that was what was intended. And I believe the analogy here, Your Honor, is to look at this like you do, for example, in a UCT context, that this was services incidental to the idea, that it was services incidental to the sale of goods. But this is, in fact, an idea that's being disclosed. As to the fact of whether this is, in fact, an idea, I would point the court to the Keller versus American Chain Company case, which I believe is a Cardozo opinion, where a tariff issue was determined to be an idea for which the employee would have been entitled to compensation were it not for the fact that he was an employee.
Well, but take it back to the agency, scope of the agency. So who would pay the lawyers?
Your Honor, I don't believe there would be any need for lawyers in this process.
A need for CPAs, lawyers, experts?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the analysis of whether RMH had or met the requirements for sole community hospital status is set forth in the analysis in the book, that 119-page book, that McKay gave to the hospital. There was not a need for anyone else to be involved in the process. If you look also at what Flagler Hospital did in the record, that's also evidence that there was no evidence they needed any other help. The hospital did themselves.
Well, wasn't there some concern that perhaps the hospital would not be successful initially? I think the legal opinion suggested that there might have to be litigation over classification. Unless they were planning on proceeding pro se, wouldn't that require lawyers?
Your Honor, in the event that that litigation was required, yes, I suppose there would be a need for lawyers.
Thank God for that.
Okay.
I'm not assigned.
Okay. Thank you. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet counsel.
That's an unfortunate adjournment.